All right, it's 11:30, so we're going to go ahead and get started. It's awesome to see a full room. Thanks all for coming to Hot from the Labs HTML5 WebSockets. I hope everyone enjoyed the keynote this morning. There's a lot of cool stuff going on, and actually a few sort of spatterings of information about WebSockets and HTML5 Labs. So we're going to take a little bit of a closer look at that and hopefully show you some things that are of interest today. My name's Craig Kitterman. I am a Senior Technical Ambassador in the Interoperability Strategy Team in Microsoft Corporate. I have with me today my colleague, Paul Badham, who is with the WCF team. He's going to join me in the latter part of the presentation to take a closer look at some of the implementation details of actually programming against WebSockets and how the protocol actually works. So what we're going to do first, though, is take a look at how WebSockets sort of fits into the overall scope of what is known today as HTML5. HTML5 is a term that's used in a number of different contexts. It means a lot of different things to a lot of people. But generally, it's considered to be a set of technologies that enables the next web. And HTML5 plays an important, or sorry, WebSockets rather plays an important role in that. It's a cool emerging technology. But it's right now in a very iterative state. And so I want to share with you sort of what's going on with WebSockets, where it is, and what Microsoft is doing to make that technology available to developers to explore and play with, because it really is something interesting and cool. So you probably heard a lot about this concept of real-time web. And this is the idea that a browser can interact with the server and exchange information in a very fast and seamless and low-latency kind of way. Push messages are one sort of personification of this notion. So one example that I often give when I'm explaining this concept to people is the classic kind of Twitter example. If you have a Twitter feed and you're looking at your timeline, and if you follow as many people as I do, oftentimes you'll log on to Twitter and you'll kind of be reading along your messages, and after a few minutes you'll see a little blue box appear at the top that says you have 11 new tweets or 20 new tweets or what have you. And basically that is, some communication took place between the client and the server, and the server said, "Hey, there's some more things for you here. There's some more tweets that have come in from your set of people that you follow. And you probably want to check back with me and get that data." But the server didn't actually just push that message to the client when it was ready. There was some other stuff that had to take place in order for the client to get that information. And trying to make that work is actually kind of a tricky problem. It's way trickier than it actually should be, in my opinion anyway. So there's a few different methods for doing that kind of thing. Now, when you're using HTTP, which on the web, that's sort of what we do, is we use HTTP, there's a couple different ways to approach this problem. Well, there's a number of different ways to approach this problem, but there's a couple that are a little bit more common. The first one is a standard polling method. So if you've been doing web development for as long as I have, you've probably written something that looks like this top one, which is every 5 seconds or 10 seconds or minute or whatever, asks the server, "Hey, are there any new chat messages for me? Are there any new updated stock prices for me? Do I have any more tweets or any more, Facebook messages or what have you?" So there's a round tripping that takes place from the browser to the server that just says, "Hey, anything for me?" And there's a polling interval of whatever is designated. Obviously, the smaller the polling interval, the more updated and relevant the information on the client is going to be. The longer the polling interval, the less fresh your data is going to be on the client, but the smaller the load on the server, the less bandwidth you're using, et cetera. So there's some trade-offs to be made there. There's a sort of philosophy about doing this known as Comet. Maybe many of you have worked with some of the methods that are sort of described by Comet. And one of those is long polling. Long polling is sort of taking this problem and turning it upside down in a way. And rather than doing this sort of request where you say, "Hey, is anything for me?" "Nope. Okay, thank you." What you do is the client actually issues a request to the server. The server then holds that request until there is a message for the client. So again, going back to the Twitter example, the server would literally hold on to that message until a new tweet came and say, "Oh, there's a new tweet. Here's another one. Here's another one. Except for when the client receives that message, it has to, in order to get ready for the next message from the server, immediately issue another request back to the server. And then the server holds that request until there's something else for the client. So you can see the pattern is not based on a time interval, but rather based on when information is actually ready to be sent to the client. Now, from a scalability point of view, this really poses a bunch of challenges. So you can imagine the web server at Twitter, sorry, this is a common example, so I use it all the time, but at Twitter, for example, there's tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of clients out there, and you could imagine if every single one of them was using long polling, that web server would be holding on to those tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of requests and just waiting to service those. So the resources that are required in order to service that type of request is tremendous. The other issue here is HTTP. For those of you who know HTTP, know that the headers that are associated with HTTP requests and responses carry a lot of metadata along with them. And in a case like this, the actual payload for a request like, do I have a tweet or how many tweets do I have, may be something as small as an integer. But if you think about all of that extra payload that comes along with an HTTP header, you're wasting bandwidth maybe on the order of 100 times or even more compared to what's actually needed to carry that payload, which is the actual number of tweets that I need to go get. So HTTP is sort of just not optimized for this scenario. And going back to long polling, actually trying to program this thing is a real pain. So it's a little bit better maybe than polling in some regards, but actually trying to make it work is not an easy thing to do. So if you've ever tried to do that, you probably know. So WebSockets technology was really designed and invented to address this problem for browser-to-server communication. Now, it's not limited to a browser, but it was sort of designed for that scenario. It gives you a fully, full duplex bidirectional TCP socket directly from the client to the server that is exposed via an API that can be programmed against using JavaScript in a very simple and straightforward way. There's the obvious bandwidth savings that I talked about in terms of just the HTTP headers and that kind of overhead. And you have the scalability advantages, meaning that the resources required on the server side in order to handle a TCP socket is much, much less than it is to manage HTTP, holding of HTTP requests in a long polling scenario. So you get a nice, thick, open connection. Messages can be sent at any time asynchronously from either direction. And then there's, an easy way to build handler code on the client and the server to actually process those messages. So the technology, WebSockets, is really a collection of technology that's contained within two specifications. There's the protocol piece. The protocol piece describes what does the WebSockets communication actually look like when it goes over the wire. So what do the actual data frames look like? How does a client and server behave? What is the handshake process? All of that is defined within the protocol specification. The protocol specification is currently going through standardization inside of IETF in the HiBi working group. Now, IETF is sort of the, for those who aren't familiar, the globally recognized leader in terms of doing standards for protocols. They're the protocol experts. And what you have in IETF is industry leaders from a number of different large corporations, every major corporation in IT, as well as a number of different special interests in the technology community, open source community, and beyond, that have a vested interest in technologies like WebSockets, and they all sit around a table and come to consensus on what gets in the spec and what doesn't get in the spec. So that's the protocol layer. Now, in order to actually program against WebSockets and take advantage of this cool bidirectional, high bandwidth capability, you need a programming framework that's easily accessible to a web developer. That's where the W3C comes in. Now, IETF is the experts on protocols. W3C are the web experts. This is where web standards really, really take place. So the W3C is building a specification inside of the web applications working group, which specifies what that interface looks like for developers. What's that JavaScript API that allows you to open a connection, send a message, receive a message, close a connection, and sort of everything in between. And Paul's going to show us in a little while what it means to actually work with that API. So just keep in mind here, there's two distinct specifications. They're evolving separately in these various working groups. Certainly there's synchronization that takes place as a feature appears in, let's say, the protocol. You know, that feature needs to appear at a certain point in the W3C spec, but these things are evolving on two separate paths. So I just want to take a step back a little bit now and talk about, you know, how does this WebSocket thing fit into the bigger picture of HTML? So there's a number of working groups, two of which we just talked about, that are working on pieces of HTML5. Now, there's a specification called HTML version 5, but there's all these other specs that are generally part of this thing that really make the HTML5 web the way that we think about it today. And all those cool demos you saw this morning are based on really this set of technologies, this larger set. And there's a number of working groups who are actually doing the work to make all of those technologies really site-ready and ready to be implemented by browser developers, and then, you know, after that, of course, ready to be implemented by the web development community at large. So you have the geolocation working group, you have web performance, CSS, the actual HTML working group, SVG, that cool anime demo this morning, that thing just blew my mind. I couldn't believe that was SVG. That was awesome. And the Web Applications Working Group, which is where the JavaScript API is happening inside of W3C. So those are some of the W3C working groups. You have ECMAScript, also known as JavaScript. That working group is actually in ECMA, which is a standards body based out of Europe. And then down in the corner here, you have HiBi, which is the working group in IETF, which owns the WebSockets protocol. So you can see there's a lot of different groups working on these various sets of technologies. Over 100 specifications included in this generally considered set of HTML5. And each of those working groups has a bunch of them. So it's not just one spec, one working group. There's a big set of specs here. And I don't expect you to be able to read that. So folks in the back, don't expect that anyone can read that. But the point is that each of these working groups is looking at a lot of different technologies. All of these specs that are in the standardization process are in a state of flux. So I think everyone who was in the keynote anyway saw that video this morning about the WebSocket spec iterating, version 76, it's now version 77, it's now version 70, whatever. And the challenges that can face. So you can see here there's sort of five generally considered states of a spec if it's going through a standardization process. This is sort of a generalized model. But you'll see it starts with a first published working draft, and then after that, there's a number of working drafts. As those consortia come together, as those working groups iterate, and they share ideas and bring input from their whether it's a corporation or their community, those specs continue to evolve. At a certain point, it reaches a level of stability where the committee members are satisfied. At that point, it reaches a last call status and eventually gets pushed through to a candidate recommendation, which is sort of like an RC from the, you know, software world, and into a final recommendation. And, you know, browser vendors have to take a decision in terms of what is the right level of stability for their users to be able to count on and trust that browser implementation of that spec. The HTML5 spec itself, for example, went to last call last May. So that just gives you an example of where we are. So Microsoft's approach, Dean talked about it already this morning. I'm not going to go all the way through this, but the point is that we look at this complicated ecosystem where there's a lot of specs evolving across this broad spectrum of HTML5 specs, and we say the ones that are site-ready, the ones that have reached this certain level of maturity where the number of iterations has gone down and there's consensus within the working groups, and there's real maturity, that's when it becomes stable and it becomes what we call site-ready. And that's when we're going to take that spec and put it into a browser like IE9. We work closely with developers through the platform preview releases and get that feedback to make sure that what we do put into IE9 is really ready. We invest on interoperability. This is all about testing, so that when you actually go and you write against, let's say, CSS 2.1, you want to make sure if you write against CSS 2.1 and you test it in IE9, it's going to render faithfully in Chrome and Firefox and Safari and everything else. So we submitted over 7,000 test cases just for CSS alone to make sure that you get that real true interoperability capability between browser implementations. And last but not least, we innovate with emerging standards in HTML5 labs, which we're going to talk about. So the history of WebSockets started out with the first working drafts of the protocol specification back in early 2009. And there were 76 community drafts of the spec that were iterated on over a relatively short period of time. So that's sort of the source of that video, was this point in time where these specs were just really rolling over at a very quick pace. A lot of things were changing. The W3C looked at that spec and said, this is going to be really important for web developers. And we need to make this something that's useful. We need to make an API that gives developers the tools they need in order to actually take advantage of this. So they started inside the Web Applications Working Group middle 2009, building the first drafts of the API spec. At the end of 2009, the protocol spec was actually brought to IETF and they said, look, we want to make this thing a formal international standard. You're the protocol experts. So IETF said, okay, we will continue to the stewardship of this spec and bring it forward. So that's been happening all along. Now let's take a look at the timeline of what the browsers have done given the context of this evolution. In January of 2010, both Chrome and Safari implemented version 75 of the original set of specifications. This is before IETF even took over the specs. So people took it, they started playing with it. Naturally, it's in the browser. It's a cool technology. People are going to start playing with it, building sites, etc. Unfortunately, what happened when version 76 came along was that there was breaking changes in the specification itself from version 75 to version 76 that rendered those implementations incompatible with one another. So there was no longer interoperability between version 75 and version 76. So whether you had a client or a server implemented on version 75, that thing was only going to work with the same. It wasn't going to work with a client or a server implementing version 76 of the protocol spec. So you can imagine this is a pretty frustrating experience for a developer. Well, Opera and Firefox joined the game at this point and said, okay, well, 76 is starting to feel a little more stable, so we're going to go ahead and implement those. We're going to implement version 76. And Chrome and Safari upgraded their implementation to version 76. Now, at the end of 2010, a security researcher identified a potential security issue in the WebSockets protocol. Now, there's been a lot of debate around the industry as to the validity of the claim, but the point is that there was somewhat of a scare among the people who are implementing the spec. The IETF working group, the HiBi working group, has since made some modifications into the protocol to actually address those concerns, regardless of their validity, just to make sure that those concerns have gone away. But in the meantime, both Firefox and Opera actually disabled WebSocket support in those browsers by default. So you can see there's a trickle of people starting to use it. Then these four major browsers implemented it. Then two of them turned it off. And the thing is continuing to evolve. As you can see on the top, in the middle row there, the 76 specs before it even went to IETF. In IETF, there's been six versions of the spec. So there's already been over 80 drafts of this spec, and it's continuing to evolve. So that's sort of the context for HTML5 Labs. Microsoft launched HTML5 Labs a couple of months ago, and the idea here is really to give developers some actual bits, some codes, a client and a server implementation of these technologies that allows you to actually go play with it, see what's possible, build some prototype implementations on this stuff, try out some new things that weren't really possible in the sort of classic HTTP realm. And see what's possible. Give your feedback. Give your feedback to Microsoft. Give your feedback to W3C, IETF, to make sure that when those specs do reach a level of maturity, that they're ready to be implemented broadly across all the browsers in a more stable and interoperable way, that the features that are important to the web development community make it into those specs. So what we've done with HTML5 Labs is we have a prototype of WebSockets, which I'm going to show you here. And what we're trying to do is really iterate on this thing on a fairly regular basis. So as IETF releases new versions of the protocol, within a couple of weeks, we're going to release another version of the HTML5 lab for WebSockets or for the other technologies that I'll show you to make sure that you're really keeping up. If you're taking advantage of this prototype, you're really keeping up with the evolution of the spec. so you know that whatever you do is going to be sort of the latest and the greatest. We're going to continue to iterate and evolve and try to stay agile and on top of these things. So with that, I'm going to take you out to HTML5 Labs and show you a little bit of a demo about what we can do with WebSockets. So first I'll show you this, just the site itself. There's a really long, horrible URL, but you can get there, html5labs.com. It's html5labs.interoperabilitybridges.com. I apologize. So this is the site, and you'll see here what we have is there's four technologies that so far we're working on prototypes for. We're here today to talk about WebSockets, but you can see also we have IndexedDB, File API, and we just announced today that we're going to be doing some interesting things with Media Capture API, and that's going to come in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned for that. But if you're interested in IndexedDB or File API, go check those out as well. But on the WebSockets prototype, we have here the ability to download the prototype. And this really gives you the code that I mentioned, a client implementation and a server implementation that you can run on your local machine. You can look at the source code and understand how these things were written. And then you can make your own implementations and prototypes to take advantage of the technology. So that's all available if you go and you download the prototype this way. You'll get a zip file with a bunch of interesting stuff in it, some readmes to help you get started. We also have a few games up here that you can play. And if you're, if you're doing this right now, please just hold on for a second because the server is limited to a small number of connections. And I want to make sure I can at least do the demo because I'm literally running this on the production server. Okay, so I clicked the one that said puzzle demo. And I have two different browsers open here. And I logged into both of them, one as myself and one as Bizarro Me, Bizarro Craig. And now I want to play this game. So practically what's happening here is I have a WebSocket connection. You can see on the top here, socket open. So I have an active open TCP socket between each one of these browsers to a server back in Redmond. Okay? And I apologize, the resolution is less than stellar here. But what this is a puzzle game. So there's a bunch of pieces here. And you take the puzzle piece and you drag it over onto the puzzle board. And your opponent does the same. The objective of the game in this case is to place more pieces in the right place before your opponent does. But the cool bit is that while I'm dragging a piece on this side, the position information from my canvas, this is using canvas tag, is being transmitted on the mouse move up to the server through the WebSocket and back down to the other client. So you can see how much data it takes to actually transmit that and get that kind of real-time performance is pretty amazing. So then I dropped that piece, and I actually got it right. So you can see my score is updated here. Bizarro Craig 1, Craig nothing. And I can do that like that. And then same thing goes over here. If I'm this person, as I drag, my position information shows up here, and I think I'm putting these things in the wrong place. I'm horrible at this game. So, all right, now the score is tied. But you can see how this works. Now, if you look down here, we have just a little log here that shows you all the messages that are actually getting sent up the WebSocket. So there's some coordinate information that's getting transmitted on a very frequent basis up to the server. The server is recognizing that, hey, I'm connected with this other guy. We're partnered for the game. He's the one I need to send the message to. So it sends the message down his socket pipe and says, your opponent's piece is now here. So render that thing using JavaScript and using Canvas on your machine. So you can see what each other is doing and try to race and get the game done. So that's an example of what you can do. On the HTML5 Labs site, there's a few other links here. There's a chat one, which, chat is sort of like the perfect example for this type of technology. You actually have a real-time chat that doesn't have any kind of polling. A couple different demos. There's two game demos, a stock ticker demo, et cetera. We also have an implementation that's using Jetty for the server side. So you take a look at that if you're a Jetty user. So what we're going to do now is I'm going to invite Paul to come up, and he's going to actually show you how to program against WebSockets from scratch and then teach you a little bit about the client-server handshaking and some of the protocol information underneath. So, Paul.
Morning. So I really like WebSockets in that it's so easy to get started doing development. I'm going to show you Hello World in WebSocket, sort of simple demo from scratch. It's not going to be fancy, but you'll see what you need to do to get started with WebSockets development, and we're going to use the prototype on the HTML5 Labs website. So I'm going to create a couple of projects. I want a client and a server. I'm going to go ahead and make my client. My client is just going to be an empty web project. So this will be a WebSocket client. Okay, and I want a server as well, so we'll add a server. For the server, I'm just going to use a C# console application just to host my WebSocket service. So I'm going to go over here and grab a console app. Okay, so I'm going to start on the server. And the idea for this is all I'm going to do is make a web page that's got a couple of text boxes. I'll type into one text box, and as I type, we'll use a WebSocket connection to send the contents of that box to a server. Server will reverse the string and send it back over the WebSocket connection. The web page will receive the reversed version back and just stick it in the second text box. You'll see some round-tripping between the client and the server, and we'll get it done in a few minutes. So I'm going to add some references. What I want is I want to grab some of the stuff that's installed on your machine, the bits that you get when you install the prototype. So there's a WCF WebSockets folder inside Microsoft SDK's program files. So we're going to go to the bin folder, and some assemblies here I want to reference. So I'm going to go ahead and copy that and go ahead and browse and add this. Oh, I'm already there. Okay, great. I'm going to add those. I also need system service models. So if you've worked with WCF at all, some of this might be a little bit familiar. The WebSockets prototype, the server implementation, is WCF based. And add system service model as well. Okay. So I've got my references. Now I'm just going to set both of these as startup projects because I always forget to do that if I don't do it now. All right. So I'm going to make a service, a WebSocket service, and I'm going to add a class. It's going to reverse strings, so we'll just call it a reverse service. I'm going to go ahead and use the namespace, the assembly I added. It's really easy to make this service because there's a base class I can inherit from. So I'm just going to go WebSocket service here. And this is what makes this so easy is it gives me a bunch of methods that I can override. So if I say override, I get on close, on error, on open, a bunch of different methods that will get called. So I want to reverse the string. So I'm just going to say string reversed is equal to string join. So what I'm doing here is I'm just reversing all the characters and concatenating them back together. And now I want to send the reverse string back. So I'll say send message, and I'm going to say reversed. So that's all my WebSocket service is. I receive a message, I reverse the contents, send it back. Now I need to host this service. Again, this would be familiar if you've done any work with WCF. You create a service and then you host it. So I'm going to go to my program. I need to grab this namespace here. I'm just going to copy that in. I'm going to make a host, and there's a WebSockets host here, and there's a generic parameter. The generic parameter is which service we want to host. So it's my reverse service. Is everything okay? Somehow I didn't get service model added. I must have screwed that up somehow, sorry. Okay, it's there now. Okay, that's fine. All right, so we need to add an endpoint for this host. We need to know where we're actually going to host the WebSocket at. So this is going to be a URI, a WebSocket URI. So we use ws:// This is going to be localhost. Sorry, full screen. Custom port. I'm going to talk a little bit more about WebSocket URIs once we get to the client. Bear with me for now, we'll just put that in there. I'm going to open the host, and I just need to stop this program from like ending, so I'm just going to do a console read line here. Okay. So this is my WebSocket server. Not flashy, but we'll see how it goes. I want to work on the client now. I want a HTML page. Now I'm going to do a bit of JavaScript, and I don't do JavaScript without jQuery, so I'm going to go and grab that. So there's a bunch of samples here that were, again, installed when I installed the prototype. I'm just going to go in here and grab some scripts. So I'll drag jQuery in, and we'll stick that in. Okay. So I need to just put a tiny little bit of markup here. As I said, I just want to do some text boxes, so we'll just say this. Whoop. Yeah, jQuery on the brain. I want a second box, which is just going to be where I put the messages. Okay. So I want to add some JavaScript. When the DOM's loaded, I want to go ahead and create that WebSocket connection. So we'll say document ready. I'm just going to make a connect function and put it in there. So creating the WebSocket connection is really easy. I'm using the native API here. So I'm going to say WebSocket is equal to new WebSocket, and I'm going to provide a URI again. So this will be ws:// Please jump, yell out if you see me do anything stupid with a quote or anything like that. Thanks. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this before I do the port number. WebSocket URIs are very similar to HTTP URIs. You can run them over SSL. So rather than WS prefix, you would have WSS if you want to tunnel over SSL. You don't have to provide a custom port number. I did because there's some limitations with the prototype today. But WebSockets is designed to run over the default ports that HTTP uses. So this would run over port 80 today. If I was to use WSS, I'd be running over 443, just like normal SSL. I also want to point out that WebSocket URIs, you can use things like query strings and stuff. So maybe if I was doing a stock ticker demo, I could say I want a ticker, and the stock code I'm interested in is MSFT. So the idea here is that you could have... You host one service, which is a stock ticker, but then it gets the query string parameter, and so it knows which particular stock code to be sending updates over that WebSocket connection. I'm not doing that today, so we'll put this back. My port and reverse, same as on the server. Okay, so this is going to go ahead and actually establish the WebSocket connection. You don't call open or connect or anything like that. And we're going to do, there's going to be some I/O there, and we want like a callback. We want an event. We want to know when the actual WebSocket connection was established successfully. So we can do that by saying on open. So here I'm providing a function to run when the WebSocket's opened. I'm just going to append a connected message just so we can tell what's going on. I also want to, at this point, once the WebSocket connection is established, I want to start paying attention to what's happening on my input box and sending WebSocket messages. So I'm going to use the key up event. So we'll say input box key up. Again, I'm just going to provide a function here to run. So I want to grab the value that's in the box and send it on the WebSocket. So that's pretty easy. We can say WebSocket send. And then I just want to grab the input box and grab its value. So I'm grabbing the value of what's in there and just sending it on the WebSocket. I also want to know when the WebSocket was closed. I'm just going to do the same thing here, except say closed instead of connected. Finally, for this to do anything, I want to know when we receive messages. there's going to be an event argument that I can use. And when I receive a message, I just want to stick the value in the box. So we say output box, value. The event has a data property. That's the actual payload, what message was sent. So page loads, we connect the WebSocket, and then we have these events. We should see some round tripping between my client and my server now. Let's go ahead, make sure. I've used native WebSockets here, so I'm going to run in a private build of Firefox that I have that supports the 0.6 version of WebSockets. And that's the same version as the prototype that supports today. So I want to run, because I'm using the native API, I want to run within Firefox. I'm just going to browse with and make sure mine. Okay, so it's called Minefield when you get a private build. But I want to make sure that's set as the default. And let's hope I didn't forget anything. Sure. Okay, so I can say hello world using WebSockets. Okay, it seems to work pretty good. So it doesn't take very long to get something up and running. But I want to show you how you could also add the same behavior to a browser that doesn't have native WebSockets support today, such as IE. The HTML5 Labs prototype has got a Silverlight component that's going to handle the communication, as Craig mentioned. And I want to show you how easy it is to sort of just drop that in there. So I have to go and grab a couple of things. From the scripts folder, there's a Silverlight WebSocket jQuery plugin. I'm going to drop that in, and a Silverlight script. I also need to go ahead and grab the client bin folder. This has got the actual Silverlight component. This is a zap file in here. So I need to go ahead and reference this jQuery Silverlight WebSocket script. And I need to make a few changes to make this work. First of all, this is not going to work if I run in a browser that doesn't support native WebSockets today. The plugin defines a WebSocket draft object rather than WebSocket. It does this so that you're not going to stomp over a browser's implementation. I'm going to say, do I have WebSocket defined? If so, let's go ahead and use that. So this code path here, we're in native mode. We're using native WebSockets. But if we don't have it defined, let's just do the same thing but use WebSocket draft instead. All right. There is a few extra steps. Sorry, there's one extra step. I have to give the Silverlight component time to load. I do this by just calling set timeout and then running connect after a second. Like, there's a few other ways to do this. This is probably just the fastest way for the purposes of a demo. But it won't work straight away because the Silverlight component isn't loaded yet. So I do that and I should be good to go. All right, so let's run it again and make sure that I haven't broken my native implementation. You can see this big blue thing loading up. So this is like a Silverlight component. So this is loading because I put the script on the top of the file. So it's always gonna load. But I've got that checked to figure out which code path I should actually run through. So just make sure that this still works. Well, great, okay. So I'm going to grab the same URI and stick it in IE. Okay, and we'll say hello world from IE. Okay, so I now have a really simple WebSockets demo that's running across multiple browsers. I like this approach of like using the Silverlight component while the spec is, you know, still in draft and is being worked on, because if 0.7, the WebSocket 0.7 comes out, I'll need to go ahead and grab a new version of Firefox if I wanted to run a website that was using that 0.7. But in the case where you're using the plugin, you could just go up to your server and put in the updated version of the plugin, and then anybody who hits that site is going to load the updated plugin. So it's got some flexibility there, which is great. All right, let's close this up. I've covered what it's like to sort of just program with WebSockets very simply. Now what I want to do is talk a little bit about what's happening under the covers. Because the API is so sort of nice, easy to use, you can't really tell what's happening on the wire at all. We don't have a huge amount of time to go into the details of the protocol, but the opening handshake for WebSockets is particularly interesting. It's the sort of the unique characteristic for WebSockets. It's why it works over the open web. So I'm going to run through the opening handshake. The thing to realize with the WebSockets handshake is that it's initiated using HTTP. So we've got a client here sending a HTTP request to a server. What this actually looks like is something that would be pretty familiar to you if you already speak HTTP. We're doing a GET on example.com/chat. So we're just saying this is the resource we want to grab. But we're saying that the underlying connection that we're using, I mean, we established a TCP connection and we're doing some HTTP traffic on that connection. We want to upgrade that connection to use WebSockets. So these two headers are a pair, they go together. You say connection upgrade and then upgrade WebSocket. Next, what we have is some specific WebSocket headers. They're all prefixed with sec dash. Purpose of this is you can't set sec dash headers on XML HTTP request. What that means is that you can't mimic a WebSocket's connection via AJAX. If you try to do it with the functionality that's in your browser, it won't work because you're not going to be able to set these headers. So this gives us some guarantee that if a WebSocket connection is coming from a browser, it's happening through the browser's API for WebSockets. And then there'll be some guarantees that the browser can make about how that WebSocket connection is going to be established. The key here, this is just a set of random bytes that have been Base64 encoded. The server's going to process this key and send a value back to the client. We'll talk about that a little bit more once we get to the response from the server, but for now this is just a set of random bytes. The origin. So we're reusing the origin security model that's already used for JavaScript today. What we want to know is the script that is creating the WebSocket connection, where that script came from. We want to pass that information to the WebSocket server so that it can make a decision about whether or not it makes sense to accept or reject that connection. The real goal here is to prevent malicious JavaScript from creating WebSocket connections that servers are then forced to honor. We want to give those servers the opportunity to recognize whether or not that connection that's being established, whether or not it makes sense for them to accept it. I also want to point out that you can have WebSocket clients that aren't the browser, and you've got no guarantee in those circumstances that the origin was actually set correctly. This is really a precaution that's designed for malicious JavaScript in mind. So it's not a blanket solution. Works for JavaScript though. Finally, I have the version. Makes sense that you want the client and the server to be speaking the same version of the WebSockets protocol. So that's what it looks like when we establish the connection. That's what goes up. Now I also want to point out that there could be a bunch of other HTTP here. You could have cookies, for example. You're not speaking WebSockets yet. That means you can leverage all of the great functionality that HTTP has. Maybe if my server doesn't want to accept the connection because what it actually wants to do is redirect. Or maybe it wants to send a 401. You need to do authentication, for example. We get a lot of value out of building the WebSockets handshake on top of HTTP. There's a lot of functionality there that we can use. Let's take a look at what it looks like if the server is actually happy with the request and wants to accept. We get a switching protocols response. So this looks like it's a 101. So this is basically, yes, I want to accept the upgrade. We have the same headers as before, the server's being very explicit about what's being accepted. The value here, I mentioned the random bytes that were being sent. The server's going to take those, it's going to concatenate a specific good, it's going to take a hash and then Base64 encode that and send that back. So why do we have this convoluted process? It's so that the client has some guarantee that it's talking to a server that actually really does understand WebSockets. You don't really want a WebSocket server. So you don't want a HTTP server that just knows, oh, you're requesting an upgrade. Sure, I'll send a 101 response to confuse things. We want to give some guarantees that the client and the server both understand how to speak WebSockets. So the client will look at this value, it'll have done the same calculation and just check that they're the same. So once we get past that, we're no longer talking HTTP. We have WebSocket data frames that are going back and forth across the wire from the client and the server. And these frames can be have a binary payload or they can have UTF-8 encoded text. So there's a bit of a discrepancy here, because if you look at the W3C API today, it doesn't support binary. And Craig mentioned that the two specifications are sort of on separate schedules. They're evolving separately. So I would expect that before too long there will... I mean, you can't quote me on this, but I would expect before too long there will be binary support in the JavaScript API for WebSockets, especially because there are some... I know some people in Microsoft that are already working with the W3C to get that through. I also want to point out that you don't have to send messages. The WebSockets protocol allows you to flag traffic that you're sending as being a continuation of some data that you already sent. And so you could send some data and then send some more and say it's a continuation and send some more and say it's a continuation. And you keep doing that, what you're doing is you're creating a stream. Again, there's a bit of a discrepancy. Again, today, the JavaScript API doesn't support streaming. We'll see what happens there. Okay, so that wraps up my coverage of the opening handshake and the protocol. I'll hand it back to you, Craig.
All right, thanks, Paul. Thank you, Paul. So we just want to wrap up with a couple of links for everyone. If you're interested by this and you want to go actually play with that stuff, again, go check out HTML5 Labs. And again, it's not just WebSockets. There's a lot of things happening there. But I'm really keen to have more people actually trying these things out, sending us feedback. What are the types of samples? I mean, if you want to see sample code that does something that's not obvious, you know, talk to us about that. We might be able to help you actually put some different sample code together. You know, engage in the process. If you're interested in understanding where the high by working group in IETF is with the protocol spec, when they're releasing new versions, what kinds of conversations are taking place, go check out the high by working group. Subscribe to the mailing list. Engage. The same, of course, goes for the W3C on the JavaScript API. I can see a lot of potential opportunity in the continued evolution of that spec with some of the features that Paul mentioned that are already included in the protocol that are probably going to eventually get rolled into the JavaScript API as well. And, of course, this is your front line as a web developer, is that actual API. This is where you're going to actually play. So engage in the process and take a look at what's happening. There's a few related sessions for those who are interested. The future of HTML5 by our colleague Giorgio. That's coming on Thursday. Data in an HTML5 world is going to talk about some different data technologies. There's some really cool stuff going on there, including things like IndexedDB and File API. That one's also Thursday. And then WCF Web APIs. There's a URI for that. I like that one. So that's Glenn Block Thursday as well. So a lot of things going on Thursday. Contact info for me if you have more questions on HTML5 Labs or the WebSockets prototypes or any of the prototypes on HTML5 Labs, please contact me. My Twitter is at Craig Kitterman, URL craig.kitterman.net, and Paul is Paul Badham and paulbadham.com. So we have just a couple of minutes left for questions, so what I'd like to do is invite everyone, if you have a question, please come to the mic so we can get it on the stream and the recording, and we'll be happy to answer questions for the next couple of minutes. Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, have you tried it through firewalls and proxies, like corporate proxies? What's the statistics?
If you're on SSL, it's pretty good. Proxies and firewalls and that are pretty used to sort of getting out of the way if you're on SSL traffic. And so I think that in practice, especially like once WebSockets is at the point where people are really just sort of developing out in the wild, but the proxy infrastructure and stuff hasn't really caught up on it, people will be using SSL. That's going to be the first port of call there to sort of address the issues. I know that the success rates that I've read on SSL are around 90% or something like that. If you're not on SSL, it's something more like 50%. But there's going to be a lot of work with the proxy vendors and that to get an embracement of WebSockets. I mean, the problem is that some of them at the moment are like looking at your request and seeing that it's got an upgrade in it and just saying, no. And I think that if, you know, as WebSockets becomes more popular, we'll gain some traction. We'll see some changes made to the internet infrastructure out there.
Yes, sir.
How do you handle user authentication with WebSockets? Do you get cookies?
So you can use cookies. You could use whatever. There'd be a number of different types of schemes you could use. There's nothing really covered in the protocol or the API. Like, none of what's being specified talks about user authentication. It's considered to be application level. However, I think eventually it would make sense, for example, for you to be able to use OAuth to secure a WebSocket connection. Because that handshake is HTTP, you can send back appropriate headers and do the OAuth process before you actually upgrade to WebSockets. Now, there's a little bit of language in the WebSocket spec, the current revision at the moment, that kind of sort of runs against that, but I think that's going to change because you can't really stop people from using HTTP for that first process for WebSockets because that's what it's based on. I think OAuth or something will work.
One more quick question, sure. Too. What other server-side frameworks in the .NET stack do you know of for doing WebSockets?
In the .NET stack?
I only know on the .NET stack of the WebSockets prototype at the moment that I was using today in the demo. I am interested in sort of I want to start talking with some of the people that make alternative web servers on the .NET stack and try to find out whether or not there's anything there. I haven't seen anything yet.
Thanks.
So we just have our prototype one.
Yeah, there's a lot of implementations outside of .NET that we've seen, you know, including
Node.js, for example, is a popular one if you're not in the Windows world, but.
Yes, sir. It's on.
Yep. Thank you. So WebSockets currently it is operated on the TCP, right? So that means does it support voice? It doesn't support it because it is only using the TCP, right?
Does it support voice? Was that the question?
Voice communication.
Well, currently, and Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, but the current protocol spec allows for binary. But as Paul mentioned before, from a programmability point of view, the API doesn't yet support any kind of binary traffic. So I could definitely see that being an interesting scenario in the future to transmit any kind of binary data practically.
You are right in that it's on TCP. There's no reason why you couldn't be sending binary voice data over TCP. And so it's as Craig says, that the real issue would be if you wanted to do it in the browser, the API doesn't exist today to do that because you can't get at that binary data via the API. But as things stand, like just today, you could have a non-browser WebSocket client using binary and you could be sending voice data over that. So it's really the browser that's the API that's there that's the limiting factor in that regard.
So I can expect FaceTime kind of applications in future using WebSockets.
I can't see why you wouldn't.
Okay, thank you.
Hi there. Is Microsoft planning on leading the way in terms of adoption with something like Exchange, like true push email or that kind of thing? Or is it going to be the opposite? Are you going to wait for adoption by everybody else before you actually implement that?
You know, I can't answer the question. I don't know specific to the product plans. I mean, what I can tell you that is as soon as the specs reach a certain level of maturity and stability, we're certainly going to be interested in taking advantage of that capability, you know, as much as possible. So specific product roadmap, I don't know, but absolutely. I mean, it's a cool technology. Microsoft is heavily involved in this process in both IETF and W3C because we see the potential for our product portfolio, not just the browser, but beyond. So there's a lot of interesting opportunity there. I'm sure that we'll be doing a lot in this space.
Yeah, it makes sense. The Exchange suggestion makes a lot of sense. But it, as we pointed out, WebSockets, it's still early days.
Sure. Thanks.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about on the server side? I mean, typically a TCP IP connection, I think I've got a one-to-one and they're stuck together. But obviously it's not the case in what we're dealing with here. And also, how do you deal with transient losses of communication to the auto reconnector?
Well,
so yes, you're on one-to-one connections with WebSockets. So a chat demo, for example, would be two one-to-one connections that the server's holding onto. Some of the examples, if you actually look at the source code for some of the samples that are up there, such as the chat one, at the moment there's just a little bit of code for you to sort of manually group connections together and then to sort of loop through those connections when you receive one and send to many. Like, I think the thing to keep in mind is that WebSockets is not, it's not like UDP, it's unicast, it's not broadcast. So if you want to do chat or something like, you know, anything like that, what you're going to do is you're going to manually group those WebSocket connections together. And then when something happens, you're going to loop through them and push a message to all of them, asynchronously, of course. But yeah. So that probably answers the first half?
Yeah, and I guess if my network connection isn't super stable.
Oh, right. So the second half, the connection stability. You get the guarantees that TCP gives you. So TCP gives you, you know, reliable delivery and that sort of thing.
This is really a standard connection, a standard socket.
Yeah, because we established a TCP connection and did HTTP over it initially, and then we keep using that TCP connection for the WebSocket. So, yes, you're layered on top of TCP, so you get reliable delivery and all the other guarantees that TCP gives you.
And I think from a programmability point of view, you subscribe to the close method, so you could say, you know, hey, if this thing closes, and I wasn't ready for it to be closed, you could run your connection function again, and basically reestablish
it. It's a common thing to use reestablishment techniques. Detect that the connection was dropped, because you might have an intermediary in the middle that just decided to kill you randomly.
And it's a pretty easy thing to sense, given the object model that exists in the API. All right. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate your time. Enjoy
Thanks
the rest
very
of
much.
Your day.